On great questions and on the gender differences, I addressed that a little bit in this paper, but just in terms of access and research, I did not interview as many women. However, there are a couple of other scholars who have worked on this and focused even more on women. Manya Stefan, who has done research among Tajik women who have gone to study abroad at places like in Egypt and have returned, and how they have very different experiences and how they're able to use that education both in terms of improving their own status, how it has helped their status in their communities upon returning, and in other cases it hasn't made that much of a difference. So she has a very, I don't remember where it was published, but Manya Stefan wrote that. And the first person that I'm aware of having worked on this, Bisyanova, Alima, wrote about, she's moved on to other research topics, but a number of years ago she wrote a paper on Kazakhs going to Al-Azhar, where she did her field work. So there are differences. There are even fewer opportunities for women upon returning to Central Asia, just in terms of teaching in Uzbekistan. At least at the time of my research, there were two women's madrasas out of a total of 10. So the rest were all male, and not too many opportunities. I mean, they're fairly small in size. Others go back to their communities and may work as spiritual as teachers or spiritual guides within their mahallas, their neighborhoods. Regarding your question about does the Central Asian countries able to provide equivalent Islamic education, it's varied among them. Among the three that I looked at, Uzbekistan has put the most resources into that on the part of the government. I think a lot of that is an attempt to discourage people from going abroad, or to say, and to be able to say that, you know, we have a number of institutions here. There's, in addition to the 10 madrasas that existed at the time, there's an Islamic Institute and then a secular Islamic university. Given the numbers, it's inadequate to meet the needs and demands of the number of students. And as we, in a conversation we had earlier in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, the kinds of issues of poorly trained imams teaching at madrasas or religious schools in those countries, that really much it mirrors the broader secular education as well. So it's not meeting the opportunities, and as a result, people continue to go abroad. And as far as I haven't studied Islamic education in Russia. I wanted to do that as part of the study, but it just made it too broad, too extensive. But I think Marlene could probably maybe address that question. But in terms of control over migrants, I know that Uzbekistan has over the last couple of years, there's been increasing restrictions on travel abroad, not just restrictions, but efforts to monitor those who have traveled abroad. So if you go abroad for more than 3 months, whereas in the past it was 6 months, yes, you'll get a knock on the door. They'll want to know the Mahalla Committee or other security services will want to know where have you been. So they've tightened that kind of, and there are other kinds of restrictions and limits also, as well as monitoring communities living in Russia. But as the point I tried to make, it's really a blurred boundary between people who are actually studying Islam abroad and learning about it from a host of other resources.
You want me to follow on this question of Islamic education in Russia? The Russian state has been hesitating between two policies, exactly the same way that many European countries. They have been hesitating between saying that they are secular state, therefore they will not take care of religious education as a state kind of program, or they are secular and therefore to be sure that they are controlling the way the state religious education will be framed, they will be involving public money in that. They are moving to the second direction, which is that to avoid having imam trained abroad, they are providing more and more public money and kind of building religious curriculum that will follow the norm of the secularity in Russia. One difference with the Central Asian set is that it's still Russia is more flexible in recognizing imams who have been trained abroad. So, in fact, several Tajiks who have been trained abroad who couldn't find a job when they go back to Russia, then they can migrate to Russia. They migrate to Russia for normal economic job, but then suddenly they realize that they can be recognized as imam in a small mosque because the Russian system will be more open to them. So, therefore, probably several Central Asians, potential imam, will find a market in Russia, but it's also a point for Russia to be sure they are controlling more and more the way they train them. On Natasha's question about national identity and religious identity, I think what is going on is that just everything related to identity become more acute during migration. So it's not that you have something really totally shifting from one side to the other, it's that everything is more acute. So many migrants, they discover their regional identity and national identity in migration. That's because they are migrating from Pamir, that suddenly they realize that, well, playing the Pamiri card can be helping them finding a network that will help them in Russia, that also make their national identity more visible. My impression is that there is no kind of Central Asian level of identity. That's not very visible. What is becoming more visible is feeling Muslim in a non-Muslim country. So I would say that's where you have a shift where the religious identity, which doesn't mean practice, just your identity, become more Muslim and less ethnic because you are in Russia. And then the debate between what is national and what is universal is in Islam is something that is really kind of one of the main topic of discussion between migrants and on the way migrants interact with proselytes or practitioner, because that's really one of the big issue of discussion. And Bayram, on your question about Central Asian state providing religious services to migrants, my impression is that they don't provide anything. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, mostly because they don't have any budget for that. So the main thing they are trying to negotiate with Russia is ensuring healthcare and pension system for their migrants. So when they go back, they can receive the Russian pension, even if they are back in their country, ensuring health insurance, like working contract and repatriation of bodies, which has become one of the big issues, especially for Tajikistan, 600 bodies at least minimal every year to be repatriated. And Uzbekistan, which is the main provider of migrants to Russia, doesn't recognize it has so many migrants, and therefore there is no Uzbek policy of trying to help their own migrants in Russia.
Thank you very much. Bayram, to your question, yes, Tablighis are more or less, coexist more or less well with all the groups in Kyrgyzstan, but Salafis. Yeah, so there is a big tension between the two. Right? The two dislike each other. You know, Salafis particularly dislike Tablighi Jamaat for their popularity and for being apolitical. Right, and Tablighi Jamaat it's a competition. You know, on this market of ideologies. Yeah? And what you see. On a daily basis, you know, this competition takes special form. You know, like, for example, in our mosque, on this daily Mashwara council, right, you often hear a person saying, okay, I know this guy, I think he's becoming a Salafi, you know. And then he puts this to the Mashwara, to the council, right, and then the Amir of the Mashwara will say, okay, who is ready to go to this guy, you know. And so they will appoint a more experienced person, and so the person who mentioned the guy, you know, will be a Dalil, like the who will guide the person, but yeah, there will be a more experienced person who will be basically responsible for talking to the guy and trying to talk him out of the Salafi practices, right? And what you see, and they continue doing that, you know, until they see that it leads to a conflict, you know. So, but it also what happens, right, is that Tablighi Jamaat, because of its popularity in Kyrgyzstan particularly, it also withdraws, you know, a significant amount of potential Salafis, you know, from the movement, you know, because of the difference in practices, right? It is much more difficult to get exposed to a Salafi kind of ideas than it is now to Tablighi perspective, which is open and public, right? And so what many experts today consider, right, is they consider the policies which are introduced in Russia and all the other Central Asian countries as Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Tajikistan as counterproductive. You know, banning Tablighi Jamaat was a not very wise move, you know, because on the ground level, it is the only major obstacles to the spread of more radical ideas. Yep. It works on like a daily basis. It works and it is very efficient, right? And that's one of the reasons sort of why the security services in Kyrgyzstan, you know, maintain that we do need Tablighi Jamaat, you know, in order, because Kyrgyz society, I mean, is extremely politicized, right? And if the Tablighi Jamaat is banned and Salafis become popular, you know, it will spiral like that. And and then to Shahmaz's questions, know how travels are managed. Yep, it depends on where these travels are performed. Right, if the travels are in Kyrgyzstan, then usually the Jamaat will take everything that it needs. Right. Dishes, you know, kitchen, even stoves, you know, sometimes gas and all the food, you know, with them. And they basically travel from mosque to mosque, hoping that there will be some kind of support from the local Jamaat, but making sure that they have enough to live on their own. When and today, you know, if in the early years of Tablighi Jamaat, many mosques were hostile, right? They just didn't know what Tablighi is, right? But nowadays, it became very popular, and there's no single mosque, except for some Uzbek mosques, you know, in the south, which do not let Tablighi in, right? But otherwise, it's like they can go anywhere. When the travel is performed in India, right, it's different, you know. Then you have this concept of Muhajirin and Ansar, right? Muhajirin were the people who migrated from Mecca to Medina, and Ansar were the local people in Medina, right? And so the Ansar gave half of their houses, you know, to the Muhajirin, you know, half of their people. Sometimes they give their wives, you know, to Muhajirin. And it's that when this union between Muhajirin, you know, and Ansar happens, that this is when really the Dawah starts working. Yep. And so what you see when you go to India, you know, you really learn that kind of hospitality. Like when I traveled, I spent $500 on purchasing a ticket and then $100 on buying some little stuff, you know, some clothing, etc. And I haven't spent anything, you know, on food. You know, everything was taken care of by the local Indian Jamaat, you know. Yeah, so they consider it a big honor, you know, to serve you. You know, sometimes you have this very extreme situation where we young people are sitting on the dastarkhan, right? And then there's like an 80-year-old man serving you tea, you know, and standing behind you. And it's like amazing. It's crazy. In Russia, it's different, right? In Russia, it's different because you're not moving from mosque to mosque. You're basically moving from one apartment to another apartment, and mostly among the local Tablighi Jamaat members, right? Okay, and the last question about the Uzbeks, why they are willing to migrate to Russia, but they are not willing to join the Tablighi movement. I think it's all about a choice, right? So when it comes to migration as an economic opportunity, right, at least as the way it is perceived, you know, there is no other option for Uzbeks, right? When it comes to choosing certain religious practices, like Uzbeks have an option, right? They have more traditional kind of conservative ulama scholarship that they preserved for centuries, right? And then you have this sort of something new, you know. And very often they would rely on the opinion of imam in their mosque, you know, because they have very strong respect for his opinion. And he would say, well, no, you know, we shouldn't go, right, just for the sake of his own security, you know, etc. So that's why it's about choice. And when you have a choice, you know, whether to do, like, to perform your namaz in the mosque, you know, or at home, right, or having to travel, you know, long distances and not knowing what it expects for you, what expects you there, they choose the first option.
All right, I'm going to ask that we have one question per person now. Starting over here, we have one person. Yeah. And yeah, you'll be second. Go ahead.
Ulan Bigozhin, Indiana University. I think it's more a comment than a question. Kind of interesting question. What happened with people who returning back after when they got like education in Islamic countries? I'm talking about Kazakhstan as an area of my research. And it's interesting to see that many of these people who returned back and studied often by their own money, they couldn't find a place in the system of Muftiyat. Because it's, I mean, Muftiyat is not like kind of monolith system. It's a different parties. It's a struggle for resource, money. And sometimes people in Muftiyat, they don't like these highly educated, in Islamic sense, people. And they send them to the remote villages, to the middle of nowhere, like village of 300 people. Guy, for example, who studied like Dawa for 9 years in Egypt. And I mean, it's a lot of jealousy and fighting for money is going on. Second question is, what is it like a radical Islam in the terms of, in the understanding of local Muftiyat? And my impression after field research in Kazakhstan, that many of imams, they kind of very suspicious of this, kind of suspicious about like about very tiny things. They're suspicious about forms, not about like, for example, like a new form of, like, for them it's a new form of praying. For example, people praying requirement part of namaz and they call it like Arabic fashion, and they don't pray a sunnah, and they just live in mosque right during the Friday praying. And for many locals whose source of education, Soviet or post-Soviet source of education, often was quite, it was local. I mean, they learned something from their grandfathers, from local mullahs who barely could speak and read Quran in Arabic, etc. This whole tiny communities become kind of suspicious of these new arrived mullahs and imams, and they starting to write complaints to the state, like, this imam is radical because he, like, prayed only like farz, and he didn't, like, he don't pray, like, he doesn't pray like a sunnah. And I mean, it's, if we look to their whole this to each country, we can see kind of similar and different processes going on.
Down here.
Kathy Kosman, U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. I had three brief points. One is in response by Ram's comment, I don't think that Muslims in Europe face a similar situation to that in Russia. One major point being that Muslims in Europe do not face a very long list of banned religious literature for which is considered extremist, for which people can go and do go to jail and psychiatric hospital. As far as following up a little bit on what Marlene said, and by the way, I thought all three presentations were fascinating, the role of Tajiks being partly incorporated into official Muslim structures in Russia, I've been told is particularly important, not only going to small mosques off, hopefully not too far north, but in other climates, in small places. One, I've been told that Ramzan Kadyrov's family advisor on Islam is an ethnic Tajik. I have no idea if that's true, but I heard that interesting rumor. And as far as the ban on Jamaat Tabligh, I've been told that it's in connection with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I don't know whether that's true, but I'd be interested in knowing if you could confirm that. Thanks.
Okay. And here, and then there, and then and there, and then there. So we'll get five in or something like that. Okay.
I have a small comment about religious education in Uzbekistan. Even though there are a great number of religious schools in the country, they are not enough to meet the local demand. Just to compare it, for example, if like law school or World Economy and Diplomacy University of Uzbekistan is the most prestigious university in the country, getting admitted to a madrasa, which just awards a post-secondary high school diploma, it's that competitive. That this explains a lot, because there is a lot of demand, but we don't have enough schools, and that's why many people tend to leave the country to seek religious education abroad. And I have one question to Emil. I'm interested in knowing more about how organized the Tablighi Jamaat is in Kyrgyzstan as a formal organization or institution with regard to government registration. And when I was in India, I have been to Nizamuddin Dargah, which is considered as the center of global movement, Tablighi movement, and where I have seen a lot of people from Kyrgyzstan. They get training there and go back to their country to do the dawah. And do they have such local centers in Kyrgyzstan, and how is their relationship and affiliation with the center, like the global leadership in India, how they get instructions or guidance? Thank you.
Back here.
Thank you. Umed Babakhanov, journalist from Tajikistan and fellow at Net Democracy Program. A short comment regarding education in Muslim education in Tajikistan. Recently, I talked to vice chairman of Tajik Islamic Institute, and he complained that they don't have enough literate, good trained teachers in the institute, and they have fear that if they send them to Pakistan, or they will have been influenced by some bad ideas, bad influence, and in Saudi Arabia and Iran, it's different Shia and so on. And then I asked, what about Russia? He said, yeah, Russia would be the good option, but, and we even received a proposal from Kazan Islamic University, but the problem that we can't send our teachers because none of them speak Russian and can be taught there. So they in big trouble, and they accept this, but problem doesn't solve. David, I would like to first to thank you for this great paper about religious education abroad. It's really good. But my question is more general. When we talk about secularity of Central Asian societies, I think we should remember that this secularity is kind of artificial. It was imposed by 70 years rule of communist in this region. For example, in Afghanistan and neighboring Afghanistan, there is no discussions should this society be secular or Islamic. All parties there are Islamic parties. And so they're different because of their economical, social, and other agendas. Do you think that in our countries, in our region, at least in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, where Islamic roots are very, very deep, in long term or in middle term perspective, states will change their secularity? So do you think that parties there and societies will switch from secularity to Islamic states? Thank you.
Okay, and then if we can come down here and then back there, and then we'll close.
Thank you very much. As Sebastian was working here at the Central Asia Program, I had several questions, but I will ask just one quick question to David. What determines the choice of young Central Asians to go to one country, to go and study to one country and not to another, for example, to go to Egypt and not to Pakistan or vice versa? Is that because they have already some networks which are connected to one of these countries, or are there other reasons, like, for example, they're seeing that they will find one of these countries an Islam which is closer to what they're expecting than in others? What are the reasons of their choice? Thank you.
And final question back here.
Nafisa Safarova, VOA Uzbek. When students travel to Egypt or Pakistan, even though they major in Islam, is it possible they study other subjects too? So once they're back in Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, they find employment in other fields. Is that possible?
Okay. So we have about 5 minutes to...
Thanks, everybody, for all the questions. could take it as sarcasm or no, I appreciate it. So on returnees who come back, I think in the case of Uzbekistan, they don't send people to rural areas. I don't think that the government trusts them to do that, especially if they've been abroad for an extensive period of time with that kind of education. I think the main approach has been to send young, relatively young imams who have been trained in Uzbekistan at the Islamic Institute, at madrasas before that, out to wherever they need to serve, often replacing an older generation. So that ensures, or is designed to ensure, whether it happens or not, that they will be promoting a particular kind of Islam that's compatible with this, with the official versions. In terms of, I agree that there's not a large number of religious schools. I said Uzbekistan has put more resources into it compared to its neighbors, but as I said, it's inadequate. There are at most 10 madrasas that can have, I think, a maximum of 1,200 or 1,500 students, which is a tiny number, really. So that's not meeting the needs. And yes, it would be very difficult to get in, given that number and the number who are interested. Regarding Umed's question, and the Russian model, interesting comment that they can't train teachers because they don't speak Russian. What was interesting in Egypt, Al-Azhar, as one of the preeminent universities of Islam in the world, they had a special program for students from the former Soviet Union. Maybe you could call it remedial Islam, as well as because they assumed that they did not have the same kind of Islamic education, religious education, going up through school. I think they, for the most part, rightly assume that. So they had to start out with the basics. But before they could even get there, they had to teach, they had to learn Arabic. So that's why there were students who would spend 11, 12 years there if they wanted to get through the whole program, but first have to study at Al-Azhar satellite schools and language and remedial religious education. So that's also I don't think that issue comes up in Russia, but you said, you mentioned the language issue. On secularity, will the state continue the same kind of secular focus? I think Generally, yes. But it'll be interesting to see as a post-Soviet generation of Central Asians come into positions of power. And we're not there yet, but once you have people who came of age or were born after 1991, maybe in over the next 20 years, 10 to 20 years, you might see some interesting shifts, not under the current leaderships, but in 10 to 20 years, we'll see changes there too. And with bringing different assumptions, possibly. Or you could. It could also be that the same approaches to governance are somehow transmitted through, you know, the current institutions, and that the elites will continue to have the same ideas. It really remains to be seen. And then, what determines the choice of where people go abroad? Yes, it's networks. Some people go because their cousin, brother, sibling had been to that institution before. Money determines it. If there's a grant, if they find out about scholarship to go to Al-Azhar or Medina, then they'll go. But for the most part, it's not theological. In fact, many of the students, and I think this was more in earlier, I don't know about right now, I haven't done field work in the last few years, many would go, they didn't know anything about Islam, they had no Islamic education. They'd end up because they heard there was an opportunity to go, and then they didn't, you know, in some cases, some students from Kyrgyzstan, for example, didn't, when they ended up in Ankara, at the university there, and had never heard of theology before. They just had no background. So I don't think theology is the primary driver here, which is just another way of example to illustrate how this is not all that different from labor migration. I mean, we're not talking about a really substantially different population. These are opportunities, and a much smaller percentage go this route, but other ones will, the majority will go to work. And they do study other subjects. I think many just, it's an opportunity to be there, and some don't even go to school. They might find a job translating for Russian tourists, you know, in Turkey or Egypt, you know. Those who know Russian, so and some of these institutions do offer other courses.
And very quickly, it's not with the Shanghai Cooperation, but it is there is a recommendation from ODKB, right, which is this CCSTO collective security treaty organization with Marlene's help there. It's the recommendation. And how Tablighi is organized, it is not registered with the State Committee on Religious Affairs because they refuse to consider themselves as an organization, but there is a what is called Department of Dawat, right? And which is under the Muftiyat, right? And it is the Department of Dawat that controls all the activities of Tablighi Jamaat and sort of approves, puts a stamp on all on the list of people who are joining 40 day and 4 months Jamaats, right? In relation to connection to India, the Tablighi Jamaat administered, you know, governed in Kyrgyzstan through the system of mashwaras, right? So there is a Republican mashwara that takes place once a month, you know, where like people from all cities, you know, get together and think about the different issues, right? Then next level is the city mashwara, right? For example, in Bishkek, it takes place on every Tuesday, you know, in the morning. And then you have regional mashwara, which is like city of Bishkek is divided into four regions, you know, etc. And then in the evening, you have the local mashwara in every mosque, right? So this is how the decisions are passed down on this weather But what is interesting, right, is that we, in Kyrgyzstan, contrary to India, for example, where we have a leader, you know, Maulana Saad, you know, who is considered to be Imam, you know, in Nizamuddin, in Kyrgyzstan there is no one Amir, right? The leadership changes is on a rotational basis. So every time that there is a Mashwara, a new Amir is appointed, right? So the decisions are made, so that we don't have one leader who would be strongly connected, let's say, to Nizamuddin, etc. Of course, when the leaders of the veterans of the movement, they travel to Nizamuddin, they do have consultations, discussions with the sheikhs in India, right? But there is no direct, let's say, direction, or, let's say, there are no directions directly coming, you know, from India, etc., particularly because of this system of Mashwaras. And I would like to add a little bit on the questions to David about the future of the government. You know, I totally agree with him, and perhaps it won't be just the generation who is born after 90s, but the generation also who is born in, let's say, late 70s and early 80s, who have also, I mean, haven't seen much of the Soviet Union, etc. So as soon as the communists, you know, or the atheists retire, you know, we will see a totally different dynamic, I think. And I wouldn't say that the countries and the governments will become necessarily religious or Islamic, right? But at least the secularism and these issues of security will not be on the agenda.
I think you have to ask it at lunch. I'm sorry. I'm just going to mention that I just want to reiterate Emil's point about the global. You know, I think that this panel really shows that when we talk about Islam in Central Asia, it is both about the local and the global. And obviously that's very in vogue in terms of globalization, but this is something that's really been happening for centuries in terms of the travelers both in and out of Central Asia that have influenced how religion is practiced there. So we still have time over lunch to approach any of these speakers to discuss